the capitalist calendar more effective here. So we'll go along with that. We'll take the May Day then and the May Day Monday. So George is going to continue our May Day discussions. George Kafensis is a philosopher and a physicist, as I mentioned at the beginning. He's been active in the Midnight Notes Collective, indeed, in 1971. In 1979, he helped to found it. And he is wrote a, edited a great journal called New Enclosures, you know, some years ago.
1990.
And here we are, you know, with these new enclosures. And George, and you've had the visual of India, and George is now going to do something, I think, really interesting. Because he's going to talk about, I believe, foreclosures and enclosures in the United States, the so-called, you know, rich first world, as if the problems there were those of the rest of the world. Is that right, George?
That's what we're trying to do.
Great. Let's give him a hand.
Thanks for coming in this evening. And I'm going to... I felt that I'm coming from the United States, and I thought it would be a good thing to do is to present some developments in the United States concerning the working class that would be very important. If I had come 2 years ago, I would be talking to you about the great immigrant demonstrations that took place in the period between mid-March and May Day, actually 2006. But this time, and those demonstrations were very inspiring and gave a real sense of a class in motion. This time, however, I'm speaking about another aspect of the American working class that is not as inspiring and poses a very serious set of questions for us, because it appears, in a way, when Rich was presenting his photos of displaced people in India in around 1999-2000, if I had the facility to put up from the photos that are now prevalent in the United States concerning the fact that we have now millions of people who are being driven from their homes throughout the United States due to what the Americans would call foreclosures and what you call here repossession. And many of these people are going into tent cities all over the United States to find at least temporary shelter in dealing with the their new state, their new situation. Where so this is a development that I must say is quite it's quite shocking from the point of view of the working class in the United States, because it shows us, as we'll soon see, that there is a serious loss of power, one might say, when in fact it is possible for capital to, in effect, use the inability to pay a debt to be the basis upon which the foundations of a person's life, of one's family, of one's community, could be destroyed. And in fact, we're not just talking about individuals here and there who are who happen to be late because of some employment issue, but we're talking about millions of people, many simultaneously within the same neighborhood, and with in fact talking about a major destruction not only of individual family life but of community. So we're talking here about commons and enclosures, and I'm afraid the United States brings news of certainly enclosures and certainly an attack on the commons. And what I'd like to do today is is somewhat a little bit ambitious. I'm going to speak to you about this crisis. I'm going to make a few observations about the very idea of crisis, what that is about. And I'm going to try to put this crisis in a historical setting, okay? A historical setting that goes back into the 19th century, and bring it up to date, and end up, I must say, with a tremendous challenge for those of us who are involved in the understanding and involved in the actual practice of class struggle in the United States, because this development is extremely poses a very serious challenge for us. So, in doing this, I'm going to go along with some of my notes and do a little reading from some of my writings of recent times, and then I hope that we're now at around 9:20. I hope to be finished before 10 o'clock. I will be finished, I assure you. 10 o'clock, whatever happens, but I'd like to be finished before, because I don't know about you, but I can see as far as I'm concerned, I begin to flag a bit in this evening. So I'm very anxious and very interested to hear your understanding of the situation in the United States and your sense of the connection that possibly might have some knowledge that might be available for us in the United States, because what I will be describing is not going to be totally unknown to you. Okay, so I'd be very interested to understand about housing activism, understand what in the past when there have been mass evictions, what people have done here, and so on. So, we're dealing here with a capitalist crisis, okay? And like a lot of capitalist crises, one looks for a way of distinguishing them, because there are a lot of these crises. They're a little bit like diseases, right? We have the Spanish flu and the Asian flu, and we have the Hong Kong flu, and so on and so forth. We try to find some way of describing these crises on the basis of what we think might be their sources or causes. So, for example, the Great Depression of the 1930s is often seen associated with the stock market crash of October 1929, for example. Or one of the most severe recessions in the 20th century in the mid-1970s, in the United States at least, was often associated with the oil price increase of 1973-74. So this is the way there's a kind of a shorthand for discussing crises. And the crisis of 2007-2008 is often, in the United States at least, called the subprime mortgage crisis. A mortgage crisis? Why should that be the beginning of a major capitalist crisis? And it's been associated not only with the subprime mortgage market crash, but the kinds of foreclosures or repossessions and the increased homelessness that it has engendered in the last year. This crisis is far from being only a crisis ignited by the subprime mortgage market crash. However, as with any capitalist crisis, it is wise to understand things at the level of appearance first. Let's start to try to understand this crisis from the way in which it is normally described. and we'll see how the application of the notion of commons and enclosures might help us analyze the crisis from a class perspective. I'm hoping that this will be a way in which, for example, we might test some of these ideas that we're talking about over the last few days, and we will continue to be talking about in the future in this conference, in this gathering. When it's normally presented, the subprime mortgage crisis usually is talked about on the basis of three different elements. First, let's be clear about what a subprime mortgage is. I'll just be a little technical now. It's just simply a higher mortgage rate than the standard one, and one that has often an adjustable rate. These mortgages often are 3 or 4 percentage points higher in terms of their interest rates than the normal mortgages that are sold to prospective house buyers, and they're most often adjustable. They've got usually the first 2 or 3 years, they have a relatively lower and pretty standard interest rate, and then in the second or third year they bump up and often go from, let's say, 7% to 11%. And the actual payments often are twice as much at the end of a 2 or 3 year initial period of a period which is, in a way, a temptation period that tempts the lender to take the mortgage and hope that within those 2 or 3 years, either their income will increase substantially, or they will be able, because their house has increased in its valuation, they will be able to get a new mortgage that would be at a lower and or an average rate, and would be able to, in effect, continue to pay their mortgage off, but at a rate that is more affordable to themselves. This is the general idea. So the subprime mortgage mortgages have increased in terms of the number over the last decade or so. And these are usually considered the mortgages of the of African Americans, Latinos, immigrants of all sorts, and generally people with problematic problematic credit scores. So this is the type of mortgage that is talked about when we talk about a subprime mortgage. And that's one feature of the present crisis. The other feature is that it's an important change, but it's not seen directly. There's been a fundamental change in the way in which mortgages are financed in the United States. Up until the mid-1970s, mortgages were basically sold to home buyers by individual banks, who would basically, in effect, you became their lender, and you would be paying directly to the bank over the period of the mortgage. Now, what begins to happen in the mid-70s and becomes especially grows to an enormous extent in the 1990s and certainly down to the present is a fundamental change in the way in which the financing of mortgages takes place in the United States. Banks, after they sell their mortgages to individuals, then turn around and sell a whole bunch of mortgages to these, in effect, large financial institutions that bundle these mortgages and sell them as bonds to likely buyers. Okay, so it's called a secondary mortgage market. All right. So in other words, most mortgages nowadays, when you get a mortgage, you think you're connected with a bank, but actually those who own the mortgage are some other financial organization that's not a bank, that in effect is selling your mortgage with hundreds of other mortgages bundled together to a bond market. Now, there are now approximately $6 trillion of bonds that are on the market that are put forward by these financial institutions. Okay, so what has happened has been a very basic change in the mechanisms by which basically capital goes into the financing home buying in the United States over the last, especially the last decade, but it's been going on since the beginning of the end of what we often call the Keynesian period of capitalist society in the late in the middle of the 1970s. And finally, an important development that has occurred has been the collapse of housing prices in the United States in the last year to a year and a half. So that actually, over this last year, we've had the first decline, overall on average decline of housing prices in the United States since the 1930s, since the Great Depression. Okay, so together, right, we have the fact that there are a tremendous number of subprime mortgages, largely sent out, largely taken up by workers at the lower end of the wage hierarchy. Okay. Secondly, the mortgages now are in the hands not of individual banks, but actually in the hands of these large financial institutions. And then finally, there's been a collapse in the housing market. Okay. Together, this has led to a tremendous financial crisis. And the financial crisis has been the part that has been most talked about, right? It's been seen as, and the key to that financial crisis is the fact that when these secondary mortgage market institutions sell their bonds which are based upon these mortgages, the actual mortgages that the bonds are based upon are not revealed to the customer. Okay, so you don't really know. A large-scale organizations or individual bond investors don't know exactly that, in fact, it's your house that's being that's part of the bond that they're buying. Okay, so that has been the basis of the what you might call the mystery that has been so much involved in the so-called credit crunch of the last half year or so, because in fact many of these organizations have refused to tell the bondholders what exactly it is that these bonds are representing. Okay? So this has been the part of the story that has been so much at the center of the discussion, a sense of financial panic among the large-scale capitalists who are involved in this type of bond market. And many of the Bear Stearns story, which undoubtedly you might have heard about, this large financial organization that had to be, in effect, saved by the U.S. government from collapse, had much to do with the fact that the Bear Stearns organization, the financial organization, had very much invested in this huge $6 trillion bond market and was not sure about what, in fact, it had in its hands. And so this part of the story, in the sense of the fact that we're dealing with a kind of capitalism of the sort that is very much at a distance from the object that is the source of wealth and value, the rise of an extremely mediated type of capitalism that has been typical of this period, that's been the object of a tremendous amount of attention. And undoubtedly, if you are a capitalist investor or you're involved in the running of a capitalist system, you'd be very concerned about yourself and your colleagues' situation in this particular matter. But What I'd like to do is to look at the other, the working class side of the story. The fact that we're dealing here with 2 million foreclosures, that this is a general estimate of the foreclosures that would have already happened or will happen within the space of the next year, which means more or less 6 to 8 million people are immediately losing their homes and are often in a situation that will lead to whole neighborhoods, in effect, being depopulated, and people leaving those areas and entering into often, as I said, ten cities that perhaps some of them actually. I must say, Rich, some of these resettlement places look a little more refined than some of the stuff that we're seeing here in the United States. It's quite remarkable and a very serious matter. Just to give you a sense of how strange things how strange this matter is moving in the United States, there's a tent city in the outskirts of Los Angeles in a small town called Ontario, California, where there are about 300 to 400 residents of this tent city, many of them the casualties of the subprime mortgage market. And this area, it's about a two-city block area full of dozens of tents with families and little children playing around and so on, and people living, cooking, in effect, on the ground. The city or the town officials are in the process of evicting a small group of the people who are in this tent city because they are not official residents of the town of Ontario, California. So they're actually being evicted after being evicted, so to speak, from their homes. So we're dealing here with a very savage moment in the development of capitalism and the relationship between capital and the proletariat at this point. 1 in 10 homes, for example, in the city of Cleveland have been repossessed and now the Deutsche Bank Trust has become the biggest land owner in the city of Cleveland. Basically, what we're looking at here is exactly what we would call a tremendous enclosure. If we considered the communities that people had created as the beginnings of or actually functioning commons of one sort or another, these are definitely enclosures of commons. And the main function, the main focus, as we see, of the up to now, at this point, of the U.S. government intervention in this story, has been largely involved in attempting to preserve preserve the financial sector from collapse. Okay, and this is typical of the kind of situation that often happens. The secondary mortgage market was introduced in the 1970s to deal with the fact that there were periodic credit shortages in the housing markets over in the periods of the 1950s and 60s and into the early 70s. And so the idea was that if there was a secondary market that would buy up the mortgages from individual banks, the banks would have more capital to lend again to mortgage buyers. Okay, but as we know, as so often happens in capitalism, these techniques that are introduced to solve problems often reintroduce these problems on a much higher level and a harsher level. We know that money is often seen to be a way in which you overcome the problems of a barter relations, okay? Money allows you to presumably be more to carry on a relationships between commodities that are more fluid and are more appropriate. So if you have the famous chicken and you have the famous apples, even if the chicken sellers and the apple sellers don't want each other's commodities, they might want their money so that they would be able to carry on exchanges even if there wasn't any particular meeting of the minds between chicken sellers and apple sellers. But we also know that once money is introduced into a market or an economy, it can lead to crises of another sort, right? It can lead to crises where, in fact, people don't want to give up their money because they don't see any way in which they're going to make any profit out of these exchanges. So they hold back their money and, in fact, create new crises of a much larger character than the inconvenience of barter that is often spoken of in these academic discussions of money and the introduction of money. So I just wanted to point out that, in effect, what from the side of financial capital, what we're experiencing now is just another example of how solutions on a higher level lead to much higher problems, because now we're dealing with credit crunches not only within the mortgage market in the United States, but it's spreading all over the planet. Okay, so that's part of the point I wanted to make. And I wanted to also say a couple of things about the notion of crisis itself. Often crises are discussed as things that kind of drop upon us from afar. But you know that it's not always the case. In fact, in capitalism, crises are often planned, they're organized, they're in effect manufactured. And often crises, the importance of crises are that they have very different effects on capital and very different effects on the working class, and especially around the question of the reproduction of workers versus the reproduction of capital and capitalists. Individual crises might have quite different consequences for different classes. It's not always even-handed. It's not always one-sided. From a class perspective, the crisis that we're talking about when we're talking about this subprime crisis, subprime mortgage crisis, is a crisis in working class reproduction. But at the same time, it is a crisis of neoliberal capitalism that is planned and is arising from a chronic and long-term tendency. It is important to focus attention on the fact that this so-called subprime mortgage crisis is based upon the efforts of immigrants, African Americans, Latino Americans to enter into the mortgage market, it's been based upon a U.S. proletariat which has seen its wage as not being an instrument by which they can gain power. The dream of wealth without work, has been the proletariat's since its birth in the land of the cane. With the inability to increase wages through collective struggle beginning in the mid-1970s, and the increased employment of women and children as the only way to maintain a family's income, the U.S. proletariat has been trying to find other ways to survive and prosper. These ways have been increasingly individualistic and parasitic upon the market. In the 1990s, many workers hoped to hit it big in the world of the stock market and in the stock options that they were increasingly offered by companies in lieu of wage increases. In the stock market boom, many workers actually considered themselves to become millionaires. But when the dot-com crash came in 2000, 2001, the dream paper became worthless, like the devil's money. After the dot-com crash, however, a housing boom began to take off. This has also been fueled by the neoliberal reorganization of the credit industry that made swift and unregulated movement of loans for real estate property possible. Within this crash, then, of the mortgage market is an attack on the efforts of millions of workers on the bottom of the wage ladder to attempt to claim a piece of American land, a home, and therefore a site of reproduction, a community, and some financial independence from capital in some future time. But this is what we mean by the dream of home ownership in the United States. As much as it is the actual tie to the work cycle that we as critics of capital immediately understand it to be. Understand that there are other meanings of home ownership for workers and their relationship to capital. For home, community, and autonomy from capital is an aspiration of a working class as much as high wages and better working conditions. As I mentioned yesterday afternoon, if we are to analyze the class struggle, we must examine it in two dimensions. Okay? One, the relationship between wages and profits. This is clearly basic. And the distance between workers and their means of production and subsistence and reproduction. In general, the closer workers are to controlling their means of production, subsistence, and reproduction, the more workers have power to negotiate for their wages and working conditions. There's a very close connection between these two, and it's long historical recognition of this fact. And therefore, it's important to see how control over the ownership of the means of reproduction, the home, the community, has affected the working class in the United States. And I'd like to just say a few things about it. I still have 15 minutes or so, and I'm going to take you through a very swift overview of the of different stages of the relationship between home and the working class. Let's start off with the first first stage, which is due, of course, to the fact of the genocide of the indigenous people, the moving of indigenous people from the land that we spoke about when I had a discussion of John Locke the other day. It's this agrarian mode of production and reproduction when the colonists and the early citizens of the United States were able to use the fact that they had control over land to parlay into high wages in relationship to capital. This was the period of the famous period when the United States was the home of high wages, and that had obviously to do with the fact that it was possible for workers to claim land and to use it, and therefore have alternatives to wage employment. This has been basic. And it lasted for a long time into the 19th century and begins to end in the post-Civil War era and comes into a tremendous crisis in the agricultural crises of the late 19th century when, in fact, the genocidaires are, in effect, genocided. They're forced off the land. They're forced into growing industrial cities, and in fact, without the type of backing that having access to land, having a center for subsistence and for reproduction, is put into that loss makes them much more vulnerable to in the negotiations around wages. In fact, this set the stage for a new kind of relationship with capital that was at that time was called Pobohemia. I'd like to remind you of one period of the relationship between the working class, its site of reproduction, and capital. In the late 19th and 20th century, there was something called Hobohemia. The hobo residents of Hobohemia were migratory workers in North America of that period who used the railroads and railroad property as their commons. Although they were individually nomadic in the sense that they did not travel in the boxcars or freight trains in large, permanently defined groups, at the same time they were quite collective in their reproduction, since an essential part of hobo life was the jungle, that is, a site located in close proximity to a railroad division point where trains were made up or where trains were to stop to change crews and engines. Hobos would congregate in the jungles where they were when they were on the road. These were the places where they could cook, clean themselves in their clothes, sleep in relative safety, share their knowledge about the whereabouts of railroad police or of jobs, and persuade their mates about their politics. Although some jungles were temporary, others were continuous in existence, even though the turnover of residents was very high. They dotted the rail arteries of the nation and provided nodal points for the practical communalization of the railway system. Though the jungles were in general hospitable places and democratic, even challenging the color line in many places, they were run on the basis of a number of unwritten jungle laws that banned acts like making fires by night in jungles subject to raids, wasting food or destroying it after eating, leaving pots or other utensils dirty after using, and so forth. These rules were strictly enforced internally by the hobo rulemakers themselves, just as they would defend the jungle from external invasion by police, vigilantes, and the Ku Klux Klan. This is a period, I'm sure that many of you have heard of the hobo world, of that period of the American male proletariat, mostly white, but in fact there was black and African American part of the hobohemia world. But it was a period when, in fact, hundreds of thousands, and in the course of decades, many millions of American workers went through a collective experience of reproduction outside the home, actually, and it set a particular kind of quality of American proletarian life, which I think was very had a profound impact, of course, on the most important one of the most important working class organizations of that time. Of any time, the industrial workers of the world, which had as their center this type of proletariat, this hobo proletariat that was on the move, that communalized, in fact, made a commons out of the hundreds of thousands of miles of rail lines that crisscrossed the United States in the first part of the 20th century. This is a model that was a very dangerous model for U.S. capital. It's not that the workers themselves used the railroads directly for revolutionary purposes all the time, but it was because many times the rails were used for going to jobs, and in fact often going to jobs repairing rails. But actually, often the fluidity of motion of the American proletariat at this time made it possible for workers to arrive at various towns and cities from across the country and flood those towns and cities and, for example, help workers who are on strike at that particular point in the nodal point in the larger American landmass. Because, as you know, the American landmass involves thousands of miles of motion. So often workers were able to concentrate large numbers in very short periods of time to win strikes and to support struggles that were taking place at any particular moment. This is, in fact, the start of an effort by capital and the state to change the way in which the home was and the site of reproduction for the working class would increasingly become the home. Okay, and in fact, in the 1930s, we begin slowly, even in the face of tremendous struggles against foreclosures, which were taking place at this time. Many left-wing organizations struggled to stop evictions from taking place in houses. The federal government, the Roosevelt government, during the 30s and certainly after the Second World War, made the home a central focus, the site of the reproduction of the working class, and made it basic to the creation of a mass worker in the United States who would basically divide their life between factory and home. Home that was increasingly, in effect, the site of some control over the point of reproduction. And in fact, the back and forth of home and job, home and factory, was the rhythm of life of the proletariat of the post-war era. And in fact, this was a very important important way of understanding how capital, in effect, made a deal with the working class of the United States to allow for a certain level of control over the site of reproduction of their labor power. And that deal begins to break down in the 1970s, and what we begin to find is a new political economy, which we associate now, which we call the neoliberal political economy. And I just want to say a few words about it, because it's a political economy that more or less is rooted in the view that the reproduction process of workers should be commodified, all right? It should be based upon, in effect, if you are to understand the home of a worker, you have to understand it as largely a collection of activities that, in effect, could be bought. Every time one does it, from the point of view of this type of political economy, every time one does something in the house, one can measure whether that particular activity, in effect, could have been done more effectively if it was bought instead of being done without being bought. So everything in the household from this perspective is really a form of commodity production or an alternative to commodity production that, in effect, is still a kind of shadow commodity production that's taking place in the household. I don't know if I'm making this clear, but I'll take another round on this in a minute. One of the most famous neoliberal economists, a man named Gary Becker, is responsible for trying to put together this neoliberal conception of what happens in a house. Right? It's the house is a sort of factory of the production of labor power, and each item in the house is to be judged on the basis of whether it's being efficiently done or not, and whether it would have been better done if someone had gone and gotten the job and paid for it. Okay, so this is a conception of reproduction and of the home, so that the home increasingly becomes the place of investment. Okay, the home becomes a piece of property that you invest in, and it's not in a place. It's not the place where you, with your immediate family and then with your neighbors, create your class power. And that's the exact opposite of what the home should be. So in fact, increasingly, there are fundamental limits, however, to this notion of a kind of ownership society. It's not unusual. I'm sure some of you, you remember the Thatcher years and the use of the home in the Thatcher years for exactly this purpose. Similar things developed in the United States in the 1980s and 1990s. However, there were fundamental limits to how far this model would go. As the New Deal model did not include much of the African-American working class, so did this neoliberal model, in fact, left many out. Many parts of the African-American, the immigrant, and the Latino working class were not part of this neoliberal ownership society. And the efforts to try to enter into it would undermine the wage hierarchy that has been always so central in dividing the working class. And what we must realize is that, and let me finish up my discussion in a minute by just putting into context the important function of the consequences of Katrina, the Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, for what begins to happen in the United States in these last few years. What I'm arguing is that in this recent period with the housing boom, there had been an attempt by large numbers of workers to enter into this housing market using the subprime mortgage mechanism. And in fact, and there was a recognition that, in effect, this was a very this is an unacceptable part. This is an unacceptable way in which workers should be responding. And in fact, one of the most important lessons that were learned in Katrina is that it was perfectly possible to enclose, to drive off hundreds of thousands of workers, especially African American workers, without consequence, in front of the whole world, including the United States. So what is exactly what Katrina taught was that in fact it was possible to carry on a new enclosure in a way that is more brutal than one could imagine in many ways what happened in Narmada. Because in Narmada they had some warning, right? You knew that it was coming up. But what happens with Katrina is that they immediately after the flooding, the army comes and stops people from going back to try to repair their own homes and to try to put together their communities. Army is set there and say, no, it's not safe for you to go back. Oh, there's mold on your wall. It's going to make you sick. You have to stay away. And force it. It's quite interesting and amazing what actually happens in Katrina. But what has happened has been the ability of the government here and the real estate developers to actually keep a large number of African Americans who had basically lived their lives and created their communities in New Orleans, to have driven them out. And it looks like, and I fear that this is so, and it's not over till it's over, but has driven them out more or less permanently. So what Katrina did is that it showed capital that it was possible, in fact, to carry on this process without consequence, without political consequence. And I must say, when we look at the consequences of a mass, we're talking about millions and millions of people being driven from their homes without the type of response that, for example, was very common in the 1930s, whether for farms or in their homes in towns and cities, where there were active anti-eviction committees set up by different groupings on the left that fought against evictions and fought against foreclosures and stopped them on a mass level. This has not occurred in the United States, I must say. I mean, there have been occasional efforts, but they have not been in any way part of the political process of the United States. And on the contrary, you know, I don't want to leave you with a negative moment, but I must say what has happened has been that, in fact, at this point, almost finished. Give me a minute. All right. It's only 10:03, so I'm not much of a liar. What has been happening is that recently in the LA area, real estate agents are renting buses, okay, packing them filled with new home buyers who are going to these areas, these communities where a large percentage of homes are now have been vacated because of these evictions and foreclosures, and they're viewing these now empty homes that are ready to be resold, and in fact they're making their pitch. Right, this is in fact what's going on. The real estate brokers are organizing at this point, and not the working class that needs to be organized at this point to deal with this math. And we're talking about a major attack on the site of reproduction of workers, and therefore a major attack on wages in the United States. Wages have been more or less flat for the last 30 years. But at this point, I must say, we're about to see if there is the correlation that I mentioned between the control of the means of production, subsistence, and reproduction, and wages are concerned. What we're about to see is a major collapse of the U.S. wage. So I would say, unless, and there's always an unless in history, unless there is a type of response that will insist that the site of the reproduction of labor power must be the source of communal of common communal power, and that's going to require a kind of movement that takes into account and sees as central the creation of the commons. And so, with that said, I'm going to.